the Rest of Us in Tech podcast. My name is Sarah Withey, and I have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Michelle Glauser. Hi, how are you doing?
I am great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty decent today. So a little bit about Michelle. She's the founder and CEO of Tectonica, a nonprofit that offers local women and non-binary adults with low incomes free tech training, along with living and childcare stipends, and then places them in positions at sponsoring companies that are ready to support more diverse teams. Michelle is also a software engineer and the lead organizer for PyLadies SF. In 2015, she spearheaded the I Look Like an Engineer ad campaign, and LinkedIn recently chose her as one of the top 10 professionals 35 and under for software. So that's quite the bio.
Why, thank you.
So I guess I want to start a little bit with Tectonica. So this is a nonprofit that gets local women and non-binaries into tech training. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of the work you do with that and how that's been going?
So 5 years ago, I was working for a startup and I was doing basically everything except for engineering. And then I kept wondering how the engineers did their work. So I Googled it and I found a new intensive training program, what we now know as a coding bootcamp. And I applied and got in, but I couldn't afford the tuition. And I was really disappointed at first, but then I thought, I'm going to come up with a plan. So I told my then boyfriend that we should hurry and get married and ask everyone for money. And that's how we paid for tuition, which is, I know it's kind of a ridiculous story, but I was really glad that I did that because the training was amazing. I loved everything I learned. And within like a few weeks of graduating, I had secured a job and tripled my income. So I was so empowered by that. And I just wondered, how come no one ever told me about this? Seems kind of sad. So I started getting involved in a lot of initiatives to get other underrepresented people into tech, like PyLadies and Women Who Code. And along the way, I was also doing volunteering in San Francisco and saw kind of the huge income disparity. And I just kept thinking, they need the same opportunity that I had. And if we were to be training and hiring the people who are already here, we wouldn't always have to complain about the rising cost of living, and we wouldn't be constantly displacing people. And I just saw that there was a much bigger need for inclusivity as far as socioeconomic status goes, and didn't see a lot of that. So after I did the I Look Like an Engineer ad campaign, which was a ton of work and just really taxing, I thought, wow, I can do hard things. Maybe I can do other hard things. And I started, instead of thinking, oh, someone should do like a more inclusive school that makes up for all the short or weaknesses I saw with other intensive training programs, I started thinking, maybe I should do that. So I did. I started it, and it's been almost two years now since I started working on it, and it's been quite the journey. So I specifically chose to have Tectonica's target audience start with women and non-binary adults because that is a very clear group that's underrepresented in tech. And kind of as a side effect of that, and the fact that we specifically are for people with low incomes, is that other underrepresented minorities, like people of color, are disproportionately represented among the lower socioeconomic levels. So we have about 75% of our participants are people of color. And it's just a great way of getting a lot of intersectional diversity into tech.
Didn't you recently just start the first, I'm going to call them a cohort? What would you call that?
We did a summer prep course. Our first full-time six-month course starts in January.
Okay. So you said it's been about 2 years in the works. What's been involved in the whole process from your first idea until now?
Wow. So many things have been involved in the process. I would say the first thing was just a lot of talking to people and figuring out if it should even be a nonprofit or a for-profit and what it would look like and if there really is demand. And so we started doing workshops in December of 2015, and all of the students wanted to come back. And the nonprofit organizations that we partnered with were really happy to have more and more of these workshops. So that was a pretty good sign. And then talking to different companies, it seemed like people were pretty excited when I told them about it. So it's just been like a lot of trial and error figuring out things and if we should go with our own nonprofit status or be fiscally sponsored, and talking to similar programs and how much they charge for their services. And yeah, a lot of research basically. And then last fall, I guess for the first year, I was basically trying to find some companies to get on board, but they all were pretty hesitant because we didn't have a class ready to go. So then last fall, I said, well, we need funding to continue this. So I did a crowdfunding campaign and raised $42,000. And then at the end of that, I found an instructor and hired her. And then we started looking for full-time students. And we found several students. And then we were still just kind of in a holding pattern waiting for companies to sign up. And it got to the point where I said, we have to get started, because if we don't, then the students are just going to have to, like the ones who had quit their jobs would have to go find a new job, basically. Oh, and I lost my instructor during that point. So it was like a lot of bumps. But I started the class full time, and I was teaching at the same time that I was looking for sponsors. And I found that by having the companies come meet with students, they were much more excited about being supportive. So that was cool. And yeah, so we basically did 3 months of prep. And during the start of the first full month, I found a new instructor, and she's been doing a great job. And after we completed that first summer prep course, we are just focusing on taking everything we learned from that and improving it for the next one, which will be a 6-month course starting in January.
So I know the nerdier, geekier side of me is kind of curious, what sort of topics, languages, frameworks, et cetera, do you guys all cover?
Yeah. So I, as a Pythonist, really wanted to do Python. I think it's just a really great language, especially for beginners. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought that it made sense to do full stack JavaScript, because that way the students would have a really strong foundation in one language that they had already used for front end, and then they'd get it in back end, and they would just have a really strong language to start with wherever they are employed afterwards. And then hopefully with that foundation, they can learn whatever language the company that's employing them uses, if it's not full stack JavaScript.
Yeah. I found once you learn the language, it's really easy to pick up the second one. Once you learn the second one, it's really easy to pick up the third one. So yeah, yeah,
same concepts, just different syntax.
Yeah, definitely. I know when I've been involved in working with nonprofits, and I even looked into starting my own nonprofit at one point, it's a lot of work. And just the more I looked at it, just like so much work up front. And like, I knew once I got through it, it would probably pay off in the end. But did you ever kind of think to yourself, like, what the heck am I doing? Why am I doing this? This is crazy. It'll never work out.
Yes, all the time. I think my question has been more like, am I the right person for this, or could someone else do this better?
I guess if I was honest, I've said that multiple times about my podcast.
Yeah. I think the right person for it is really the person who just does it. Like, that is the thing that has gotten us this far, because I'm willing to just keep pushing. And I tell people this all the time, that I don't think I could be an entrepreneur and handle all of the stress if I weren't doing something that I thought was as meaningful as Tectonica is, because it's so much stress. And it's only the passion for the cause and the belief that it's a good thing that will help multiple people that keeps me going when it's really tough. It's kind of funny, because when my spouse will like occasionally play devil's advocate and say, well, maybe you should just give up on all of this, instead of it being like, oh, maybe you're right, it makes me mad. And then I just want to work harder.
I get that entirely. I'm kind of curious now that you mentioned the name a couple of times. What is the origin behind the name Tectonica?
Oh, you know, I could not think of a name. And I had this doc with like everything I'd been researching and thinking about just called like the tech training program or something. And one day the word tectonic just popped into my head. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect if we spelled it with an H, like tectonic, because it had multiple meanings to me. Like, first of all, we're in the San Francisco Bay Area, earthquake country. So we're like tectonic, you know, tectonic plates. And then also I feel like this is a program that is meant to do some moving and shaking of concept or like our ideas around supporting locals and how to build diversity. So that was another thing. And then I also was like, okay, it's like a tonic for tech and a tectonic for people. So that's pretty cool. But then I found that there was already kind of a similar program in Colorado, I think it was. And I was so disappointed. And then one day I thought, oh my gosh, what if we added an A on the end? It would be so perfect, especially with our target audience. So I added a name, and that's how the name came to be.
And the rest was history.
Yep.
So you mentioned that you were a software engineer at one point. You went through kind of a coding boot camp sort of thing and then became, had such a good experience that you decided to work on this. What made you decide that you really wanted to make the switch from engineer to nonprofit entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah. I never, ever, ever thought I would do nonprofit stuff. I've always been interested in startups and entrepreneurial stuff, but I had never, it never crossed my mind that I might do nonprofit stuff. But then when I was talking to an advisor about this, she said, this is a clear nonprofit model. And I thought, I don't know about that. But I was convinced once I realized the companies that would be funding the students or participants would probably be happy to have a tax deduction. So that's what convinced me. But I will say the reason I decided to make that switch is it's definitely the I Look Like an Engineer ad campaign. I was so passionate about that cause, and it felt really awesome to be working so hard on something so big and that had so much meaning to me. And I just was so motivated by that. And I thought, wow, I would love to do more work around diversity and inclusion. And then, like I said, all of those issues I saw around displacement and people needing the opportunity to have education that would get them into tech made me feel like that was the thing I could do that would be diversity and inclusion related.
Nice. I guess speaking of the I Look Like an Engineer ad campaign, I know when I saw it, it was still really early on. It wasn't even viral or anything yet. And a friend of mine showed it to me. I'm like, that seems fun. So I kind of going with everybody else's things where they had a sign that talked about what they did. I wrote out a sign real quick and held it up and took a picture. And it's this awkward selfie where I was trying to like do that. I posted online and then, you know, a couple hours later, just so many tweets and so many people were getting onto it and it kind of took off. What made you decide to do an ad campaign based on that? Because it was a billboard in San Francisco, right?
Yes. So where do I start? My spouse's coworker at OneLogin was on some ads for the company. They were recruiting ads, and right on the ads, they showed a picture of her and said she was an engineer. And within a day of those ads being up, she was getting responses online of people saying, oh, she must not really be an engineer. She doesn't look like an engineer. They probably just hired a model. They want to just build diversity or whatever. And he told me about it, and I was so mad for her. And I was also really mad because she was getting a bunch of emails asking her out. And I was like, seriously, this is just, yeah. So I reached out to her and said, hey, solidarity. And then I said, hey, I have an idea. Maybe we should put up a billboard in response to that, and we can just show a bunch of underrepresented engineers. And she said, I like where your mind is at, but I think you'll blow up the internet. And she said, let's just do a hashtag. And I was like, oh, okay. So she posted her picture, I posted mine, and then I shared it in like every group I could think of, and it took off really fast. And we weren't expecting that at all. Honestly, we were just like, maybe a few people will like it or share it, but we didn't expect millions of people to participate in it. So that was really cool, totally unexpected. And the next few weeks after that were just ridiculously busy. But yeah, within a day, I said, well, clearly they're like, we could do a billboard because so many people are interested in this. Let's do it. And I told a bunch of the lady nerds, one of the groups I help lead, about my idea, and a whole bunch of them wanted to jump in and help. So we put together an event and had some speakers and had people come get their pictures taken for the billboard. And then we put together a crowdfunding campaign, which we had never done before, but we have a member of the group who worked at Indiegogo, so like helped provide some guidance there. And then we found out within, I can't even remember how long, but very quickly we found out that we were asking for way too little. We started the campaign at $3,000 and it turned out we needed closer to $30,000. Oh, no. So at the event, I was like, thanks to everyone who contributed. We need more. And yeah, it was tough after that because the beginning we kind of rode the wave, and then after, I don't know, virality works that way, I guess. It's just really fast at the beginning, but then I had to spend the rest of, or like the last couple of weeks, really, really pushing to get more people to contribute and to get some companies on board. But yeah, it all worked out. And we were also able to find a partner company that does ads. And they had two software engineers who said, hey, this thing is happening. We need to donate our services to them. So they found all of the spaces for the ads. They were able to get us remnant ads, which meant there were a lot more of them because they were cheaper. And they went up all around the Bay Area.
Nice. Because I know, I think I saw like one or two of them on Twitter, but definitely, I didn't know they went up all over the area. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I made a poster out of it too, because I was like, people should be able to just print this out and put it up in their offices and stuff.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
And a lot of people said, like, why isn't there a call to action on this? And we kind of tried to get there to be a call to action, but in the end it ended up just being a big billboard with the I look like an engineer thing on it. And I just told people, you know, this is about awareness that there are people dealing with discrimination. It's about giving them visibility. It's about helping people who are underrepresented and who wouldn't think of themselves as ever going into an engineering program feel like they could. So hopefully it did that. It got quite a lot of views as far as, or that's what the ad company said anyway. There's not a good way to count, but
yeah,
they think there were quite a few.
It'd be fun if there was somebody up on there, can like one car, two car, three cars, four cars. kidding.
That's they, a terrible I think job. They have some way of estimating, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Impressions. That's what they call them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So I know you're starting another apprenticeship session in January. Do you see this expanding and growing into either larger sessions or into different cities or just more different sessions at the same time in San Francisco?
I absolutely think there's room for expansion. I did a whole bunch of research and found that all of the cities that have the highest number of tech jobs available, so high income disparities. And I just, oh, it's so terrible. Why do we talk about being very innovative, but then we aren't figuring out how to solve social problems? So yeah, I think we can definitely expand. We are going to be doing 15 for the session in January, which is more than we did for the summer prep course. And from there, we can probably grow to some different locations in the area and then beyond that.
I know finding sponsorship is always hard for about anything you ever want to do. Has it been hard to find additional people that want to get into one of these sessions, or have they kind of?
Oh my gosh, no. Everyone wants to get in. We specifically decided not to open up the application process to just anyone because I felt like a lot of the kind of workshops that are out there, it's all the same people who know about them, who already have really strong networks in tech, who already could probably afford to go get a new bachelor's degree or a boot camp, which is like $15,000 to $28,000 these days. So we purposely partner with nonprofit community organizations and have them invite their communities to our introduction workshops. And then at those workshops, we say, we also have this full-time apprenticeship program. Here's how it works. If you're interested, let us know. And then we have like this quite lengthy assessment process just because their stipends and the training, it's all funded by companies. We want to make absolutely sure we have people who are dedicated and really interested and smart and a lot of other things. So yeah, we have this long process and then we accept the best. And then they actually have a few weeks of training and the top ones are accepted to the longer program. So
that's great. Yeah. What would you say is maybe one of the biggest things you've learned through the process of getting Tectonica up and going off the ground?
Oh, the biggest things I've learned. Wow, I've learned so many different things. I guess probably one of the biggest is that you have to have things be as official as possible from the very beginning, even if you don't think you do, because things will come back to bite you. Yeah. And I learned that very quickly, and a lawyer said, it's unfortunate that these things happen, but now you know, and you learn quickly. And I was like, oh, okay. So now I try to hash out everything beforehand, even though I've always been the kind of person who just wants to hurry and get things moving. I have to repeatedly remind myself that it's better to take a little bit more time and make sure every detail is ready to go. Yeah.
Probably pretty smart, especially with like so much money involved and so many moving parts with people and companies and all that going on.
Yes, it doesn't feel like much money though. Oh my gosh. It's like we always need more. Budgeting is a really hard thing that I still struggle with because it feels like I'm just making up numbers all the time. And it's not like I'm thinking, oh, how do we make this money stretch? I'm really great at that. I can do that for a very long time, and I have been doing that for a very long time. But it's the, like when I'm applying for grants and they want an idea of how much every little thing costs, it's, you don't really know how much it's going to cost. You just kind of guess. So,
or you do, and then the numbers change later. Or
yep.
So moving on, I know you're also involved in a whole lot of activities, Pi Ladies SF and Lady Nerds and Diversity Advocates. You want to talk about, one, I'm just curious how you have the free time to do all this, but two, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in all these things too.
Yeah, so Pi Ladies was just a natural fit because after the boot camp that I did, I wanted to get involved with other women who coded in Python. And Lynn Root was leading that in San Francisco. And when she moved to New York, she said, Michelle, I really want you to take this over. And I was like, I don't know if I have time, Lynn. And she's like, no, really, I think you'll be fine. So I took it on. And the first year was really hard. I felt like I probably spent like 10 hours a week on it myself. And then January of this year, I was like, no more of that. I don't have time for that. I've got to get Tectonica off the ground, and I just decided that I would basically, I put out a call for volunteers who wanted to help organize events, and then we had a meeting and I had a spreadsheet and I said, these are the events we want to have each month. A lot of the details are up to you, but I found people to, or companies to host them at their spaces. And I just need you to like handle all the details. And then I had a Google Doc that has an easy bit.ly link that I can send out to companies and have them sign up. And then they all just filled in their names. And I basically just have to do the like following up with them to make sure that they're working on it and answering any questions that they have. And yeah, some things have fallen through, but oh my gosh, it's so much better than last year. And I am very happy to have all of their help. And I think it makes things better too, to have a diverse set of people working on events because they come up with different ideas. We do have a lot of things that are regulated now that I'm really happy about. For example, instead of having to like go back and forth on picking a date, I made a Pilates Calendly so companies can just book a date and we have it and are ready to go. And we have a whole template of all the things that you need to include on the event description to make it really inclusive and informational. So I was really happy to figure out a way to continue to make that work because I've heard of other groups where the leader just didn't have time anymore and it just kind of died. And I didn't want it to die because I still thought there was a lot of value. And then Lady Nerds is the unofficial alumni group from the coding bootcamp that I attended. Okay. And that is probably my favorite Slack channel because it's people who have been through a very similar career transition. And most of us live in the same city. So we just have a lot in common. And we have channels about every subject you can imagine. And I think that's probably the first place I go to when I just need someone to give me a random opinion or I need to vent about something. And yeah, it's really great. And that was the group that helped with the I Look Like an Engineer app campaign. It wouldn't have been a reality without all of their help. And then Diversity Advocates is this really awesome group of people who are diversity and inclusion professionals in the tech industry. And I was a member of it, thought it was pretty cool. And they just started asking for people to be on the leadership team. And being the over-involved person I am, I thought that would be a good idea. But I've actually quite enjoyed that because I am really passionate about that. And I love having that gathering of ideas on how to make sure you are following all the best practices and like brainstorming for new ideas on how to make tech companies more inclusive. So that's pretty cool. And I guess I will add to that. I cannot stress enough to people how important community is, not just because underrepresented people are definitely going to need people they can identify with to vent to when they deal with discrimination, but also because even if people try to pretend it's not, so much of the tech industry is about connections. And if you don't have connections at a company, it's not likely anyone's even going to call you about a resume you submitted. I just love having that support system, and I'm constantly re-realizing how important community is. So being involved in all of those makes me feel like, A, I can make a difference for other people, and B, I'm connecting all of the different projects that I'm working on. Like occasionally we'll have a Pilates event where Pilates volunteer to help with Tectonica stuff. Because I think there's so many people interested in being involved in different communities in different ways, and it's impossible for everyone to be in every community. So why not have them all work together?
I like that. I know from my own experience, both online communities and local communities, it sometimes takes a while to find a really good community. But once you find it, it really is just amazing that you can go in and ask questions. You can say, hey, this is driving me crazy. But also, like you said, kind of the networking. I found from all my interactions in communities and Twitter and Slack and all sorts of things, like I've had a lot of doors open up for me and it's been pretty impressive. And
yeah,
I'm feeling really good that I start able to open up doors for other people as well. It's really important.
Yeah, it feels great, right?
Yeah.
It's like paying forward the help that you found from community before.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I feel like it's time to move on to the really hardcore, hard-hitting questions. Are you ready for this?
Yes, go for it.
What was the first thing you wanted to be when you grew up?
An author.
Like what kind of author? Sci-fi? Fiction?
Like
historical romance?
Regular fiction. No.
Just a fiction.
Modern
author.
Fiction.
Modern fiction.
Yeah.
That works. What made you slowly stray away from that?
You know, it just... That is a really good question. I still feel like I'm very much a writer at heart, but I also often felt like that wasn't a really great way to make a living or an easy way, which is funny because what I'm doing now is not easy. But I eventually said, you know what, that'd be really cool if I could be a professor of literature. So I was aiming for that, and I figured that on the side of that, I would be writing. And then I wrote my master's thesis on mommy bloggers and other women's autobiographical acts on the internet, and was just so fascinated by that whole new scene of being able to like basically write a diary online and even having like sharing your life in 140 characters. That's really interesting to me. So I decided I wanted to do a PhD in digital humanities, which was a little more specific than literature. Yeah. And I didn't get into the program that I applied to. And I was already kind of wondering if I really wanted to do that. And that's when I was working for that startup and decided to learn how to build websites. So it's been kind of an interesting path, but I think it's really valuable. I think it gives me a lot of different perspective that can be useful. So, yeah.
Yeah. As you've been talking, I'm just kind of thinking to myself, like, I started out super technical because I learned to program when I was in elementary school, and it fascinated me. It's what I've wanted to do my whole life. And thankfully, I was able to do that. But as I've found out the last couple years, I'm starting to do other things that aren't technical, and it's becoming a little weird. Like, whoa, I have these hidden talents almost.
Whoa, like, I'm doing other things.
I can do things besides tech. It's... I joined like a local women's chorus, and that's been kind of fun. Like, ooh. I can sing. And you mentioned mommy bloggers, which is how this train of thought started. But there's a show called Listen to Your Mother, and it's kind of a citywide spoken essay sort of show in different cities across the country. And I end up writing a essay about me and motherhood and how I thought it'd be kind of difficult for me, and end up giving it at this group, which is not like... I've spoken at a whole bunch of conferences, but this group is like totally non-tech people at all. So it's been really interesting to read that essay in a spoken form like I'm used to, but not in any sort of group I've been used to talking with. Like the other, I think 11 people were all like moms or, you know, someone in the kind of arts and humanities areas. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't. And it was still fun. I'm really glad I did it. But just kind of the exploration, I think, has been kind of interesting, and kind of the same for you. It seems like kind of an interesting transitional exploration.
I'm kind of jealous of you that you have that really technical history. I really liked playing with technical stuff, but I just didn't have the right people to tell me that there were options in tech. I had no idea, but I loved to play with DOS. I was the only person in the family who figured out how to like move around and look at directories and stuff. And then I was in the multimedia club at school, and I was in, there's a club called the X Filers Club, like EXE.
Nice.
Yeah. We played with some Visual Basic, and I thought it was so cool, but I just like somehow didn't connect the dots that, oh, this is something that can be really creative and that could be a really great career, and that that this, like what I'm doing is computer science kind of. So yeah, that's why when I started learning engineering and loved getting into tech, I was like, how come no one told me? All those people who are like, wow, that girl really likes to play with DOS. Why didn't they tell me something?
I don't know. Love that.
Maybe just because I was a girl.
Yeah, I mean, we had a Commodore 64 growing up, and my father taught me the command.
Now, that's really fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Type in the command to make you run a game. And I'm always like, this is a weird, like, there's stars and quotations and numbers, and like, what's all this mean? And found the manual one day, and I just kind of looked at it and found the command and learned what this all meant. I'm like, that's cool. Wait, there's so many more commands? And just kind of started reading it, and I just got sucked in. And I'm going to admit how totally nerdy I am. I learned, like, to count in binary and Boolean algebra and nice. All sorts of stuff, like, early on. And my parents were all just like, whatever, we don't know what you're doing. I mean, there wasn't really any encouragement there. So people weren't even really guiding me. It was just kind of like, wow, this is fascinating. And it just never went away, I guess. And then I finally learned.
That's cool that you had that manual.
Yeah. They were like 250-page manuals at the time. And nowadays, they're just kind of like, everything should run itself. And back then, you couldn't. You just were given a prompt and didn't have the foggiest idea what to do. And you needed that manual to tell you.
Yeah. Wow. I wonder what it would have been like for me if I'd had a manual. Would I have done that same thing? Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I felt like everybody just knew what they wanted to be when they grew up, but I come to find out going to college, like, why are there so many, like, undeclared majors in here?
Like, you know, at one point, I had three majors and four minors.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, doomed to be mediocre at everything, right?
But hey, you're not mediocre now, right?
Depends on the day.
No, quit that. One of my favorite questions to ask lately is, what's the coolest TV show or movie, book, comic book, album, any sort of like entertainment medium you've listened to or read or watched lately?
I recently read Marilynne Robinson's Lila, and I can't even explain. It put a spell over me. It was just achingly beautiful, I guess is a good way to put it. The language was beautiful, and the fact that the main character, she just had this really haunting past that colored everything else she did. But then she, like, found someone unconventional to love her, and, like, she was unsure about loving back. And it's so beautiful. I didn't want to finish it. And now I'm reading some of the others in the series, and I'm like, oh, man, Lila was the best. It's a good one.
Yeah. If you had some sort of superpower, what superpower would you like to have and why?
Superpower. Wow, I would like so many superpowers. I would like the superpower of having all the superpowers. Is that a superpower?
I think your brain would explode if you tried to.
Okay, how about, you know, that clock thing that Hermione has in Harry Potter? So she can turn back time.
You're going to take away my geek cred. I haven't read or watched Harry Potter.
All right. She has this clock thing. It's a necklace. And she turns it and it'll turn back time. And she loves it because then she can attend multiple classes on the same day. But it backfires because she burns out. And I always have thought, well, why didn't she just turn it back and go to sleep for one time? So I think it would be pretty cool to be able to turn back time. That would be awesome. And then I could use what I had learned to fix the first time, I guess.
I like the geeky way that, like, everybody I keep talking to usually has some sort of answer, but they spin it in some sort of alternate way. Like, I'd like to turn back time, but obviously I'd turn it back so I can sleep more and catch up with...
Yes.
Loopholes. I like it.
Yeah.
All right. So if we were to go to a coffee shop and sit down and just geek out about something for hours, like just jabber on and on and on about it, what would that geeky topic be?
Oh my gosh.
What's something you just dive into, like, oh my gosh, let me spend 6 hours telling you about this really cool thing.
Oh, wow. I think 5 years ago it would have been mommy blogs or just blogs in general, because I just read hundreds of them every day. Holy and God. Was so fascinated by that. But now, honestly, my life is so much about Tectonica. There's not much else. So I would probably just want to talk about diversity and inclusion stuff for 5 hours. I could totally do that. And about the different issues I'd heard of and people's ideas for how to fix them and what different companies had tried and companies that are currently on the blacklist and all of that stuff.
And I think that is like the perfect sign of what you're doing is definitely the right thing. Because I know somebody told me, like, would you open up a coffee shop if you hated coffee? Like, you could make money, but you wouldn't really have the passion for it. It would probably show in the operation of the business, but you know, you're not just running this because you think you can make a bunch of money, and you're not running it just because somebody told you, like, diversity, inclusion, it's going to be the new trend. You know, you're doing it because you really care. You really want to see people succeed. You want to see the diversity ratios better in the tech world. And I love seeing you so passionate about all that.
Yeah. You know, I just want to add really quickly that I am so grateful to the people who have helped educate me on different things. And I know that it's so much emotional labor to be constantly educating people who don't get it. But I feel like 5 or 10 years ago, I felt like I was kind of a baby feminist, but I didn't know that much, especially about intersectional feminism. And I've learned so much since then. And I have physical reactions sometimes to my strong feelings about how other people are being treated. And I really want to be the best ally I can be, but we all mess up, you know? So I guess that's my caveat for saying I'm really passionate about inclusivity, but that doesn't mean I'm perfect at it and know everything.
Michelle and I actually met in person at AntComp, which is an intersectional feminism code retreat, I think would be the best thing to call it.
That was the coolest event. I loved it.
Yeah. And I had so many people like, Sarah, you should go. You should sign up. I'm like, okay. So I went on the forum and like name and where I'm located and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, I can do all this. And then it's like, tell me about intersectional feminism or what you know about it. And I remember at the time, this was like the middle of last year. And I'm just like, I don't even know what this term is. I had to go look it up.
Really?
And I'm just like, oh crap. Like, I'm not going to know anything about this. I'm not going to go to this cool event. And I looked it up and I'm just like, oh, I know what this is. I just haven't had a term for it. And I wasn't really, I guess, like book smart. I guess I would be more street smart. Like, I've dealt with these issues and I, you know, worked with them in communities and stuff like that, but I hadn't ever had a term for it. I haven't ever done like good book research. So I found it interesting to try and talk about, you know, like this is definitely an important thing and I've done work with it, but I never knew what the name of this term was.
Yeah.
But it's really important. And I love seeing the groups that don't just make an effort to just like, oh, hashtag diversity, but you know, like let's get into the guts of this. There's really a lot more to just get women in tech. We need to get like all sorts of women and people of color and LGBT and all sorts of people in.
Yes. And so many people ask me which companies are doing diversity right, but it's the companies that aren't constantly bragging about it that are doing it right. You know? So it's hard for people to like hear about them because they're not bragging about it. So I think that's another value of having a network, because you've got that whisper network of people who are like, oh, avoid this one, but I've heard this one's pretty good.
And definitely one of the benefits I've had in getting involved in really good communities is being able to have that. Well, there's that tweet that secretly all the women in tech all know each other and they talk about everything.
Yeah.
It really is almost
yes,
true.
We do know each other. Yeah, basically.
Really, yeah.
I've only ever met one woman who's in software engineering who was like, whoa, there are meetups? Like, she didn't know. It's like, yeah, there are a whole bunch of meetups and there are Facebook groups and there are Slack channels and all sorts of things.
And I think I've only met them if they've been like really new to the industry. If they've been in it for a while, they probably heard about these, but yeah.
True.
So I guess my last couple questions is if you had something inspirational or some sort of advice you wanted to mention to a podcast audience of, I hope, several thousand, what would you want to say or why?
Value your community and try to be a value to others in your community. So important. I would also add to that, I guess, that for the people who really put a lot into making sure that communities are valuable to community members, you should show them your appreciation. And yes, obviously, the best way is to give them money sometimes. yeah, it's a lot of hard work. And especially for those who have the least amount of privilege and are trying anyway to make a difference, send them your tips and appreciate that emotional labor they put into it.
Good words. Thank you. So the podcast is about over. What would be some good ways that people could get a hold of you if they wanted to? Social media or anything like that?
Ooh, hands down, Twitter is the best way. Yeah, I guess just emailing me is fine too. MichelleGlauser@tectonica.org.
All right. So I really love having you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sarah.
So this has been our episode for today. I'm Sarah Withy @GeekyGirlSarah on Twitter. And stay tuned for our next episode. Thanks. Bye.